We are fortunate today to have Dr. John Hintz back with us again for a third webinar in our second strand here. Topic for today is using progress monitoring data in an RTI model. Dr. Hintz is from the University of Massachusetts, and we're very excited to have him back with us today. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Dr. Hintz. Just a reminder, too, that we will have a recording of today's webinar available on our webpage, which I'll post again in the chat. Thank you, everyone.
Okay. Thank you, Molly, and good afternoon, everyone, again. I should have scribbled some names down the past week to see if there are some returners, and this way I wouldn't have to go through the same spiel every day. But as Molly said, my name is John Hintz, and I'm at the University of Massachusetts. I'm currently the director of our school psychology training programs. For the last number of years, as you can see on this slide, I've been involved with a number of different federal centers geared toward the use of RTI. Our first center, going back about 10 years ago now, was the National Center of Student Progress Monitoring, and that that was a five-year center, that transitioned to the National Center Response Intervention. That's the one you see on this slide here, and it's one that oftentimes people are familiar with, given the topic area. That center has, I'll say closed down, but it's been transitioned into the National Center on Intensive Interventions now. But I like to keep the old web link up there because everything that we did with the previous center was there, is still there for your use. www.rtiforsuccess.org. And you can go to our other center, too, as well, intensiveinterventions.org as well. So today's topic is progress monitoring, and it brings us somewhat full circle, although that's a bit of an overstatement probably. I don't know that we could ever get full circle with a topic as large as RTI and three one-hour webinars. But the first webinar, we talked about an overview of assessment and how assessment fits into RTI, if folks were there for that first one, hopefully you have a better appreciation for the role of assessment now. If we remember back to my three concentric circles, they were assessment along with intervention and then the use of data in making decisions were three of the key features that I believe that are critical to any RTI model. Last week we talked a bit about screening methods and what screening use was for, how to evaluate screening instruments, how to make some decisions on the use of screening instruments. I brought a couple slides today in to kind of further kind of elaborate, but just reinforce that. And then today we're going to be talking about RTI and progress monitoring information. So if we were to follow it chronologically, we're at a point now, if I was thinking back to last week, we have some students, we've screened our classroom or our school or district or whatever your unit of analysis is. We have some students now that we've identified as potentially at risk, and we want to bring them in for some type of intervention. We start to do that, and now today's topic is how do we progress monitor their progress over time, and importantly, how do we make decisions on that? For those who have your RTI or MTSS models up and running, you probably have come to that point once you have students in Tier 2 or Tier 3 in your progress monitoring, and the question comes is, okay, well, how much growth should we expect? Is it enough? Is the intervention being effective and the like? And without some critical pieces of information that perhaps are heuristic, those are hard to do. Okay, so it's not simply enough to just collect the data and kind of look at it, or what sometimes we call visual analysis, but there are probably more sophisticated ways that we can do that and more empirically valid ways to do that as well. I'm just going to review briefly last week. We talked some about progress monitoring or making decisions with benchmark and perhaps with benchmark data, and I think perhaps I might be a little bit different in this respect than some folks is that I consider benchmarking, that is, to be a form of progress monitoring, if you will. So typically we think about progress monitoring at the individual level with single students, time series graphs, weekly, so on and so forth. But I think that, and hopefully if folks were here last week, that benchmark assessment can be a form of progress monitoring as well. The unit of analysis is different. The unit of analysis typically then is at the aggregate level. So I changed our triangle a little bit. I think I had mentioned last week or the week before is that, you know, some folks have a 3- or 4-tier model. You notice in this one, there's 4 tiers, but just the 4th is specialized learning, and that could be special education, as it is in your state. But the types of progress monitoring that are done in benchmark assessment, usually the focus of attention is between tiers 1 and 2. And I just figured this out finally. I was looking for a draw feature, and I finally found this little pencil I can use to do that. So typically, we are making decisions between tiers 1 and 2 with benchmark assessment. And a number of different questions then will drive our assessment practices at this level. One, which we talked about somewhat last week, was that what are the number or percent of students who are responding to the core curriculum? And in essence, for me, that's one of the key features of benchmark assessment or progress monitoring across, you know, seasonally from fall to winter, winter to spring, and then 1 year to the next, is what are the number of students who are responding to the core curriculum? And this would be particularly, I think, relevant for districts or schools that were undergoing some kind of curriculum change. So, for example, if you adopted a new curriculum and you had some benchmark data for previous years, you could monitor the progress of your students in the aggregate in their response to that core curriculum. So I want to highlight, because I think that's one a different form of progress monitoring, but since a salient one too as well. More of a program evaluation effort. Second is, and probably as we all know this, is who is most likely in need of some tier 2 intervention? And oftentimes, that's the only question that we ask of benchmark assessment, is who are the students who we should bring into tier 2 intervention? And while that answering that question is probably important in and of itself with RTI, I think in at least attending to some of these other questions, we really get the full benefit of the RTI and a progress monitoring system. Another question might be, who needs enhancement? And then sometimes who are these children? These might be our real high-flying students in tier 1. You know, oftentimes we're trying to think about those students who are at risk and in need of supportive services, but there might be some students who are so far beyond the benchmarks that they're so green, they're the brightest of green, if you will, that perhaps we can look to some kind of enhancement for them, or maybe even curriculum compacting. And then lastly, and we'll talk a little bit about this, is how do individual students then progress from one benchmark to the other? And this will be a key feature in one of our heuristics later on about and attempting to answer the question, is the intervention being effective? Regardless of it's in tier 2 or tier 3, we want to attend to where students started with respect to the benchmark, their benchmark assessment, and then are they making any gains into the headwind, if you will? I think I talked about last week, benchmark assessment as being what we call sometimes a relative form of assessment. Relative meaning is that any one individual student score is considered relative to the other students in their class or their grade or their school or even some kind of aggregate. And we talked last week about having two types of aggregate, either a local aggregate or a national aggregate. I'm going to show you an example of what I meant by that here in a minute. So that's an important feature then, is monitoring their progress from one benchmark to the other, in addition to looking at their progress week to week in response to the intervention. So what might these things look like then? For you AIMS web users, you'll recognize some of these next couple slides, but typically we get our data reported in some kind of table like this. And let's say if I've taken out the children's names, but you can see that they have 2 scores here, one in their reading curriculum-based measurement. You can see the top score there is, or the top first student on top, they read 144 words correct per minute, and it placed them at a percentile rank of 94. If we go across, you see that they had also read, responded to their maze with 25 correct selections, and that their instructional recommendation for that student is the right benchmark and keep it at grade level. So this is commonly, and this is oftentimes a report that you would see, notice that the colors aren't all stacked up together because it's usually it's reported in the manner in which the students are put into the database. Here's another example, and this is sometimes a little bit more helpful for us because it summarizes the data for us. Here, this is just another table where the students then are presented with respect to their instructional recommendations and not in an alphabetical name order with respect to like their last name or stuff. So those top blue guys might be maybe candidates for some kind of enhancement. Then you can see we have a whole host of green. And if we were to put this into a kind of a histogram or a triangle, I suspect it would look pretty much like what we'd expect because those blue guys would be considered green too as well, meaning that they're meeting standard. It looks to me about 80% of them are green or blue. Then we have only three of the students who are yellow and then one who's at red. But this gives you a quick snapshot. The other thing, too, I like about this is that it gives you the target score at that time. You can see where students are relative to that. This next one is one that's probably my favorite, and I mentioned this last week, and I know I wasn't really clear about what it was, but the reason why I like this one so much, and this is obviously for Ames Web users, is that it gives the students' scores their score, and then it gives you their percentile rank relative to both a local and a national norm. Remember last week we had a conversation about do we use local or national norms? When is the best time to use one or the other? But if we were to look here, for example, let me pick one out. Here's a student down here. Whoop, no, I got to follow that. There it is, right here. And you can see with the score of 53, there's the score right here. Their local percentile is about 28th percentile. And if you're using the, we talked about the 25th percentile as being a possible cutoff. Here's a student that if we use the local norm, we might say, okay, they're fine. Let's wait until the next benchmark and see. But if we look at their national norm, you can see they're at the 11th percentile. They're truly struggling here, or at least, let's say, at risk for literacy concerns. If we were to look at these local norms compared to the national norms, if we look at them collectively, the local norms are higher than the national norms. What this tells us is this is probably a district who performs lower than the national norm. It seems kind of backwards than you would think, because that same score represents a higher percentile rank locally, and it's lower nationally. Here's another student, though, too, as well, 38th percentile with respect to their local norm. Typically, a percentile rank of 38, we say, oh, fine, that the child's, they're well within one standard deviation below the mean. But if we look at their national norm, here I'm mucking up my table here, but a score of 23 would rope them in below that 23rd percentile. So this would be potentially a child who I would worry about that if we use the local norm consistently over years, that gap would get bigger and bigger between what they're able to do compared to typical peer development at a national level. And that gap would get large enough that at a certain time, usually again between the grades of 3 and 4, about the ages of 8 or 9, that it gets pretty big and it's hard to really have a demonstrable effect on that gap at that point in time. And in the first webinar, we talked about these kind of developmental nature of assessment and why it's so important within an RTI framework to consider the developmental nature or when and at what time during the course of a child's development that you're assessing. So I just brought those in quickly because I think these, again, can be used to monitor the progress of students over time or classes over time. And there's actually other graphs too within Ames Web that will allow you to stack the fall to the winter to spring. And I'm just using Ames Web as an example because I know that other products do as well. And we could use those as forms of progress monitoring. Right. So just the quick review there is that I think it's important, at least for me, to consider and remind myself of that benchmark assessment is a form of progress monitoring. It's just not a summative evaluation that we do 3 times a year to try to figure out who our tier 2 students are. But more importantly, it's a way of evaluating the effectiveness of our overall curriculum or instructional strategies to aggregates of children as they pass through our school system over time. Obviously, realizing that the children from each year are going to change. Most of them will change as they move up through the grades. The focus of today then is once those students go into tiers 2 or 3 or 4, I'd even say, or let me say in special education, how do we progress monitor them? How do we choose the types of progress monitoring systems that we use? How do we present the data? And then how do we make decisions on the use of make decisions on the basis of those data as they come in? Again, here the basis of our decision making, the focus of our decision making would be between then tiers 2 and 4, or for youth, all would be tiers 2 and 3, and then special education being 4. Our assessment questions, again, would be, what is the student's rate of learning in response to the intervention? Okay, we have to have some type of number that summarizes their growth during the time that the intervention is being implemented for us to then evaluate. And I'll show you how we do this, again, using AIMSWeb as an example, because they provide nice rate data. So that's one assessment question. Another one is, how does the student's rate of learning compare to peers? And this is an important part of the equation here, because oftentimes I'll see folks, you'll get that summary graph on most of these systems, AIMSWeb and Dibbles, as well as other ones, that summarizes the student's growth over time. And it tells you, gives you usually represented in a slope or growth coefficient. But importantly for us to determine whether or not the student, is the intervention being effective enough, we have to compare that student's rate of learning to what we typically see during peers at that time. A couple weeks ago, I made mention that someone one time in a workshop said to me, wow, this is you're trying to hit a moving target here with this kind of assessment approach. The standards and criteria are always changing. And in fact, they are. It's because those students who are at risk and struggling with their literacy development, when you compare them to their peers are not staying stagnant. They're getting better as well too. And in fact, that's what creates that gap that we all oftentimes refer to. And I think I'd mentioned earlier on that gap in reading was originally coined by Keith Stanovich, the Matthew effect, borrowed from the biblical passage where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. But when you look, if you ever read that article, what he's alluding to is that the gap is not as wide as, early on, grades 1 and 2. But as the grades, as we move up in grades, the gap gets larger and larger. The troubling aspect of that article is that as we go up in grades, that gap gets larger and it gets harder to close. Right? So comparing a student's rate of progress in response to the intervention and then comparing it to peer standards is an important part of the process here. And then probably importantly is making some determination as to should the student remain in the current tier, meaning is the intervention being effective and perhaps maybe it just needs more time, or should they move to a more intensive tier, say tier 3 for a student who's in tier 2, or perhaps consideration for an eligibility determination for a child who's in tier 3, or then importantly, can we move a child back to tier 1 too? Have they made enough progress that we can move them, consider them back into tier 1. So those are the kind of questions that we can gather or answer from these types of assessments. Before we do that, though, we have to have some kind of goal to compare our standards to. Okay. Now, this or at least for some of the software programs that I'm familiar with, is probably the most challenging aspect for some folks because it's a box and it's staring you in the face, and you have to put some number in there in order for that goal line to be configured. Typically, in RTI, with most of the time series programs, we're always comparing a student's trend line, meaning what's their actual growth over time, to some goal line that we've set. Without goals, it's very unlikely that we're going to see the types of student progress that we'd expect in order to close that gap. In fact, the the literature on goal setting is very, very, very interesting, because if we set really ambitious goals, we're not likely to meet them, because we kind of shut them out of our mind really quickly. Oh, they're just too tough. I'll never make it. Real easy goals, we also sometimes too aren't highly motivating, because we meet them very easily without much work or effort. Moderate goals, though, are the ones that provide the most type of intervention or motivation. And we hear this other areas too, like scaffolding, instruction, and the like. But how we set a goal is real important, not only to the student, but interestingly to the teacher as well. And Lynn Fuchs did some work on this many years ago, where she demonstrated that while they might not do it consciously, or people, they might have not have been told to do so, when teachers are provided with graphic forms of data and told something about what the goal is, and if it's a reasonable goal, they change their behavior, that is, their instruction, to try to meet those goals. So setting goals in appropriate fashion is really, really important. Now, we have a couple different ways that we can do that within an RTI framework, depending on what kind of data that we're dealing with. Again, most of the time we're dealing with continuous data, and I'll make the plug again. I know I've said it a couple times in the last 3 weeks, is that if your progress monitoring data or your data system is similar or the same to your benchmark system, then you can answer these types of questions that we'll see here in a little bit through just a decision-making heuristic. Because if I take AmesWeb or Dibbles as being the most common forms, they both use oral reading fluency as the basis for screening and then progress monitoring. If you use one system for screening and another one for progress monitoring, then it's very hard to tell later on. You'll be able to answer questions like, has the child responded, or are they responding to the intervention? What's the response like relative to their peer group? But then tying that back to the benchmark assessment, that is, have they improved enough that they can go back to tier two or tier one, or is it not enough to move to tier three, are very hard to do without having a similar type of data collection systems across both forms of assessment, that is the benchmark assessment and progress monitoring. So anyway, so one form of one approach to goal setting is what I just simply call the end of the year benchmarking, okay? And this is a very simple process, and many of you might be already intuitively doing this on your own, but you simply identify an appropriate grade level benchmark. You would then, if you were doing it in like an AmesWeb or Dibbles or something, the software program will automatically do this for you, but I'm going to show you how you could do it in Excel or in a PowerPoint graph here in a moment. Place a mark on the student graph that corresponds to the time in which you expect the goal to be met and the level at which the goal should be met, and you'll see that in a moment here. And then connect where the student currently is to where you'd like to see them, their goal, and that sets then sets the standard for progress. So here's an example of an AmesWeb chart, an old AmesWeb chart I can see from here. And if, by way of example, in this case, I'm working with a third grade student, and let's say just, again, for example, they're in tier two intervention. Doesn't really matter where they're at in terms of the percentile right now, but I would like to set a goal of getting them to the 50th percentile. You can see a score of 29 in the spring corresponds to the 50th percentile. It's likely that in this example, this child has just been benchmarked in the winter. Right, and they're somewhere, they either come up color-coded as yellow, or they're below the 25th percentile, depending on, again, my decision-making structure, like we talked about last week. So my goal minimally for them is to read 29 words correct per minute. Oh, you know what? I can see that this is not a word. This is not words. Right? This comes from a math. This comes from a math chart. But anyway, let's keep with the example. Their goal is 29. If I simply, this is their last couple data points. Yeah, I can see now it's in digits correct. Sorry about that. And if I want to set a goal about 10 weeks out, okay, you can see here the last data point was at week three, and then I'm going to set another one, you know, about 10 weeks out, and I wanted it to be 29. That should correspond to right around here, about 29. And if I just then connect those two points, I just use the median at the baseline, that is the goal line, okay? And that goal line does a number of different things for us. One, it sets the standard for progress week to week. And this is a key feature, something to understand with progress monitoring, is that this line, this goal line, is what we sometimes refer to as a dynamic goal line, in the sense that dynamic means it changes from week to week. There was at one time way back when in CBN literature, we used to set static goal lines just like this, as I'm drawing in here, right? And what we found, actually, I was the one who did a lot of this research. I remember one study we did some years ago. We had children come in, and we monitored the progress weekly, and they were just randomly assigned to one of three conditions. One in this, what we call a static goal line, right? So we just told them, listen, buddy, your goal is 29, and even at week four it was 29, and that's your goal, and let's see how well you do, we administered a probe, and then we kind of sent them on their way, give them a little feedback. I'll describe the feedback in a moment. The second approach was this dynamic goal line, as you see here. And then the third approach was what we provided them with no feedback whatsoever, any graphic feedback. And if I could take, let's say, a youngster here, maybe at week four, let me just draw a data point in here quickly. So if this child was in the static condition, they would come in, and it looks like they read about 15 words correct per minute. It's very nice already. That's almost double, 100%, but they've done quite well considered to their baseline. The guys in the poor static condition, though, we had a little protocol that we'd read off. So they said, wow, I read 15 words correct per minute today. My goal is 29. Oh, darn, I didn't meet my goal. And that sets a different kind of motivational standard than the second child who came in and said, oh, today my goal was about 10 words correct per minute. If I can just see this line and draw it over here, 10 words correct per minute. Today I read about 15. Man, I did really well. I exceeded my goal really well. That sets a different framework from those poor guys in the static condition. And then the third guys, as I said, didn't get any feedback. And what we found, not surprisingly, is that students who got some form of feedback in a graphic form, they outperformed students who didn't get any feedback. But then when we looked at the feedback or the graphic conditions, students who received this dynamic goal line did much better than students who, in terms of their growth over time, than students who were in the static goal line. Okay, and that wasn't surprising. And just so you know, too, is these were general education students. Teachers did not have access to the graphs. So I guess it's plausible that students were going back and talking to each other in their classrooms. I think they came from six different classrooms, as I remember, about their goal line. We don't know if they did or not, but the students did interesting things. They tell us, wow, I know what you guys are trying to do. You're trying to help me read here. So I'm actually practicing at home. I went and got some books out of the library, things like that. So this goal setting is an important thing. So just by examples, I'm going to go back so I can clear this. This first approach we just call the end of the year goal, or some using a yearly or benchmark approach to that. So if it was in the fall of a given year, you could use the winter as the benchmark, and if it was the winter, you could use the spring. By convention, we like to use about 9 or 10 weeks in between our benchmarks, so that we'd always draw that goal, our expected goal, to correspond to the next benchmark. Okay. Now, I do know that there's kind of this notion about how many data points or how long should you progress monitor is of some question. But what we have found unlike behavioral kind of interventions, where it's, we oftentimes see very quick and rapid changes, particularly if the intervention is effective, instructional interventions, academic interventions, take longer to show learning occur. So it's unlikely that we would typically see demonstrable growth within the first 2 or 3 weeks. But likely, if that we wait for another 6 or 7 weeks, we would see those kind of changes. So in effect, what learning with academic, it looks more like a scallop. You don't see much for a while, and then you see this kind of growth like that. So we've evaluated a number of different graphs over years, thousands of those, and looked at that. So that's why we've come to this conclusion. It's probably minimally we like to use the between each of the benchmarks as the timing for our progress monitoring. We've even went so far as to try to figure out our different interventions, do they have different growth rates and response rates? And we've applied for federal funding a number of times on that question, and it appears that the federal government is not as interested in it as we are, because they have been unfunded. But anyway, sometimes the question is, how long should I progress monitor? So typically that's what we do. Okay. Another approach, rather than highly similar, but a little bit different than the using the benchmark approach, is to use a rate of growth approach. Here's an example. Now, on this far right column, we've talked a little bit about these in the past, and this graph stands for ROI, rate of improvement. And typically, the kinds of progress monitoring systems you'll use will have some kind of rate of improvement metric that you can use for this. You notice that in this case, it's again, I'm sorry, this is it's a math one, and it corresponds, this 0.5 corresponds to the rate of growth of that's associated with the 50th percentile. Obviously, if this was a reading example, the numbers would be larger. They'd probably be in the areas of 2 or 3, somewhere in there. But what we could do then is, so if this is the typical rates of growth, then this is what we'd like to see our struggling students be able to approximate. We're going to use this as the basis for making our goal. And in this case, it's a quick little algebra here that we can do. We simply multiply the number of weeks by, or the rate of growth by the number of weeks that the intervention is going to occur. In this case, I used an example of 16 for whatever reason. So there's 16 more weeks left in the semester. This is probably right after somewhere after our winter break. And we're going to set a goal for right through the end of the semester. And then if they meet it in the spring, then we'll be fine. But it will be a goal that will be able to take us from when we come back from break just about to sometime in June. You can see that if we expect students to grow a half a digit a week, this is an old example here, we'd expect them to improve about 8 digits correct per week. But if we just put in numbers there for reading, for example, and let's say it was 2.5 words correct per minute per week, would be 32, it would be about 40. We'd expect about 40 words improvement over those 16 weeks, right? We take this number and then just add it to the baseline number. And again, the baseline can be either the median of your last benchmark assessment, or sometimes it's for students who are currently in progress monitoring. And if you want to use the last couple data points, the median of the last couple data points to do that in the progress monitoring data run, you could do that as well. But in this example, we just have this 14, and we're going to simply add the 8 to the 14. We're going to get our goal now for that student is going to be a goal of 22. So within 16 weeks, they'll improve from a benchmark of our current score of 14 to 22. And if I just quickly put that into a reading example, if we currently had a student, let's say in the winter of third grade who is reading 55 words correct per minute, we want them probably to read about 95 by the spring or something like that. And then the process, very similar as before. We're just going to simply plot our goal out by the number of weeks, and then connect the two with a goal line, connect the two, and that's going to serve as our goal line. And we're going to use that goal line a little bit later on for making some decisions as well. So for those of you who use programs like AIMSWeb or DIBLS or other ones, Wireless Generation is very similar, some others as well. You have at least two ways that you can set that goal or fill in that little box that's oftentimes just staring you right on or staring you in the face. Some of them, in fact, I like kind of DIBLS display better because it gives you the benchmark. It superimposes the benchmarks kind of on the back of the student's data sheet as you read. So you can see the student's individual data, but you can see if they've made headway into the benchmark, kind of superimposed and almost like a watermark in the back of the report for them. So we have some kind of benchmark goal that we can use, or that we can use a rate of improvement approach to set either of those goals. Okay. Lastly, a third approach, and sometimes this approach is helpful with students that they're either so low or so below the aggregate or the whatever norm you're using, or their performance has been so inconsistent that you don't know what kind of growth metric to use. This third approach, it might be helpful. These students that oftentimes might be in special education, for example. I should also say, too, here, if I went back, typically our approach to progress monitoring is to use the progress monitoring materials that correspond to the student's current grade level. Okay, sometimes I know oftentimes when people ask me, if I have a student in third grade, what level should I progress monitor them at? So our basic really is that we say is typically is we would progress monitor them at their current grade level, because our goal is to get them show improvement and hopefully get them back into tier one in current grade level materials. This third approach could be one that you could use for students when you're progress monitoring them off grade level, which is oftentimes the case with students in special education. And in doing so, what we typically do is work back. We use a survey level assessment and work back through the subsequent grades to find the level at which they are that we feel comfortable at. In fact, before, let me just demonstrate that. I probably, as I'm thinking now, if I go back to a previous slide. If we had a third grade student, or let's say fourth grade student, who was in receiving special educational services, and here in the fall they had a score of 9, right? That would be so below. That'd be below the 10th percentile. It'd be in the last decile. Obviously, it wouldn't make much sense to progress monitor them in fourth grade material. Let's say then we gave them third grade material, and they had a score of 10, right? Okay, well, third grade, they did a little bit better, but still, the score of 10 is going to get you to the 10th percentile. Probably still too difficult yet. Well, let's go back to the second grade material. Let's see. Okay, second grade, they had a score of 12. Well, we can see that a score of 12 is going to put them somewhere in between the 50th and 75th percentile right here. Just for interest, let's go back to the first grade material. At first grade, they had a score of 15. Well, a score of 15 is going to place them above the 90th percentile, so that's going to be too easy. So in that case, we'd probably use, even though the student's in fourth grade, we might use second grade materials as the basis for progress monitoring. The reason that we do that is, particularly for those students who are so below the current grade level of progress monitoring levels, is that it would be senseless to continue to monitor them at that level. You won't see any growth. You won't see any growth at all because it's just you reach a there's kind of like a ceiling effect. They just can't, or it's actually a floor effect in this case. It's just too hard for them. In this case too, you won't probably see. If I looked at first grade, you probably won't see much growth either there as well. The material is just simply too easy, and they'll probably can do very, very well, but you won't see that slope of growth that you typically would expect to see. When you carefully choose the level of difficulty and then match it well to where the student is, it provides a window, the broadest window for you to be able to show and demonstrate your growth and skills. Then with the snow falling, we're getting another little storm here tonight. If I use the skiing example, if you put me up on the double diamonds and said, okay, John, show me what you got, it's just going to be too hard, and I'm going to just use survival skills to get down the mountain. On the other side, if you just put me on very easy beginner green trails, I'm just going to hope to get up enough speed where I can make carve some turns and the like. And again, I'm not going to be able to probably show you too much in the way of growth. But if I have a nice blue or maybe just a single diamond slope, I'll be able to show you the kind of skill development. If I was looking to improve my skills, I'd just like to survive the day at my age right now. But that would provide me with a nice window, the broadest window, to be able to demonstrate to someone what I was able to do on skis. So I just want to mention that because when we get to this level of the intra-individual, let me skip ahead now. It could be the case that we might be progress monitoring off grade level. And what we do here with the intra-individual approach is essentially is what we use is the student's growth over some point in time in some grade level to provide the basis for making the goal, okay? Once we have that, and it's summarized by slope, and I'll show you here in a minute on a graph, it's easier to see it. We multiply that slope, their current slope, by 1.5, and this is a constant. Why is it 1.5? Well, this again comes from some work by Lynn Fuchs and her colleagues down at Vanderbilt some years ago that showed if we used 1.8, that multiplier is just too hard. It creates goal structures that are too difficult. If it's lower than that, 1.2, 1.3, it creates goals that aren't of much difficulty. If we multiply it by about 1.5, it prevents that window where they can grow into, and it provides motivation for them to continue to grow. Once we've done that, we're going to multiply it by the number of weeks we have in our intervention, add that to the student's baseline scores we've had before, and then we'll have an end-of-the-year goal. So what does that look like? Here's a little data run here, okay? It's 3, 6, 8 data points. If I were to summarize those data points, we have a slope of 0.625. Okay, and that's that. What that represents for those who don't know, I think many of you probably do, but is that from 1 week to the next, whatever in this case we're measuring digits correct, the student grew on average 0.62 digits correct per minute per week. Okay, on average is the important thing here because on this week certainly they went down from this week to this week, and then other weeks they made more than average growth. Okay. The other thing, too, is that, as I was saying before about how many weeks do you progress monitor for, is that we know, is that the more data that we have, or it's actually an interaction between data and time, the more data points that we have, the more accurate estimation of this slope that we get, okay? So, for example, if I was to just cut off the first 3 data points and created a slope on that, you could see that that slope would be much different than this one, okay? Or if I use the second 3, it would probably look like this. Well, all 9 of them, or 8 of them together, provide a pretty good estimate there. So anything less than about 8 to 10, we start to get in an area where we're probably dealing with slope estimates that have some level of unreliability in them. So anyway, in this case, here's our slope for those 8 data points, 0.625. If we just take the example here, we're going to multiply it by 1.5. Remember, that's our constant, and we're going to get 0.9375. I could probably just round this off to 1.1 or 1.00 for government work. Multiply that by the number of weeks. I just kind of arbitrarily chose 12 weeks here, and that would get us, 11 to 12. We want to see them grow about 11 to 12 units here. Add that to the baseline. And this would be our end of the year, or whatever our goal, not end of the year, but whatever we'd want the student to be at when we next assess the goal, okay? 23.25, or just simply 23 would be, in this case, I call it the end of the year goal, but it can just simply be the next time we sit down to evaluate a student, all right? So we have 3 approaches that we can set goals with. One is choosing a benchmark, usually corresponding, and again, you can either choose the 25th, I would say either minimally the 25th, but maybe preferably the 50th percentile to use, and then choose whatever score corresponds to the benchmark period that you're interested in, be it the winter or the spring. The second approach, we can use the rate of growth approach, and again, we could typically here, I would definitely advocate using the 50th percentile, because if students aren't growing at a rate that's at least average or approximates the average, they won't make any headway into closing that gap, right? So if we only expect that they grow at like the 25th percentile, it's likely that they'll probably maintain that gap, or the gap could even get wider. But we know that they'll probably maintain that gap, but we won't be closing it in any way. And then lastly is that we have this intra-individual approach, because we use the student's own data over some time to as the basis for formulating the goal, okay? So once we've chosen a goal structure and we have some progress monitoring data, again, preferably about 8 to 10 weeks, as I said, by convention, we use, until the next benchmark period as the standard for us, for the number of weeks by which we collect the data. Then we can ask at our next benchmark period, This is what it looks like. I'm sorry, we didn't go to the next goal. Then, and that previous example would simply look like this. Okay, if we drew that out, or Ames, Webb, or Dibbles, we'd do that for us, it would look like that. Once we have that information, then we're able to answer some questions on the basis of the data. Now, this is oftentimes, this is where I don't, this is going to say maybe a little bit higher level skill that once districts are involved in RTI after a year or two, that we want to start to see, because then you're making full use of the data. And here is just, as I say, it's just a little decision making heuristic for use in goals tiers two or three. Again, these would be students who are receiving some type of instructional intervention. So it would correspond again to a benchmark period. So let's create an example again. Let's say it's about, we're coming up on our winter benchmark here in a couple of weeks. We've had a student who has been getting intervention since the fall benchmark, and when we come up to that winter benchmark, what we typically do in our schools is we'll sit down, and all those students who are being progress monitored in tier two or tier three, we sit down and we look at the data and then make some evaluation as to their tier status. But what we're really doing is, how have they responded to the intervention? Okay, has the intervention done what we intended it to do? So if the student is at or above benchmark, we simply go back to tier one, okay? Now here is the case, you could actually say, well, we don't really care what the rate of growth was, because whatever it was, they got back into tier one. But the way that happens can be one of a number of different ways, but here are two typical scenarios. One is a student who was really close to the cutoff before in tier one, just below the cutoff, and probably got over the benchmark within the first couple of weeks in the intervention. In fact, I think in last week we talked about an example where for some students who are just hovering right around that benchmark cutoff, we might want to progress monitor them. One alternative is to progress monitor them for a couple of weeks to see if it was the timing of the benchmark that had to do that had anything to do with their status. So, one of the nice things is that most of these assessment instruments provide us with these benchmarks, but we don't really know when the benchmarks have been taken. In fact, if you look at, the aggregate data for AIMSWeb, that could be anywhere from the first week of September. Actually, it could be starting as early as August for, districts in the South and the Midwest. And I know one of the challenges for those districts for a number of years is that AIMSWeb didn't open up the benchmark assessment portal until September, and you kind of have to hold on to your data for a while. Or it could be, to late September, again, depending on your district. So a brief run of progress monitoring could maybe help you ferret out those guys who are just hovering around the tier. So those students, those students oftentimes are, next time we evaluate them, are back in tier two again. They straddle that benchmark. Sometimes people will ask, well, what do you do with those guys? So, what we advocate for is what we call them is kind of long-term tier twoers. These are not students who need special education. What they are is that students who that the core curriculum is pretty successful in meeting their learning needs, but what they need is a little bit more. When I think in week one we talked about the differences between a standardized intervention in tier two and an individualized one. I know last week we talked about where does the role of instructional consultation come in, and I think that the critical the amino acid, if you will, in the standardized approach, the one-size-fits-all approach, is that students get they get extra practice, if you will, in some of the critical skills that are most essential in the core curriculum in those tier two interventions. Okay, the other type of student here is that there's a student who might have been some level below the cut score, but has really made demonstrable gains. So I want to look at that slope coefficient, I want to see how much they grew, and I want to learn something about what the intervention was as well. And I think I shared an example with my older daughter some years ago in the area of math. And, she just had that kind of epiphany, aha, I finally got it. She cracked the base 10 system, and since then it's been flying high. Another kind of child that you oftentimes see. Students who are, so those students who are meet the standard will go back into Tier 1. There are another group of students that are still below the benchmark, as you can see here, but are making adequate progress or maybe even exceeding the progress. Now, where do we get that? I think I have it on the other slide, but I would always use the growth, the slope coefficient or the growth metric that corresponds to that 50th percentile. So I think before it was a 0.4, as I remember. It's kind of a funny little slope there. But here's a student who maybe still hasn't met benchmark, but let's say he's growing at 0.8. They're doubling the expectation. What should we do with those guys? Well, what that is really telling you is that these are students who probably started some level below the benchmark, but whatever you're doing is doing quite well. They're actually being very responsive. What they need is more time with the tier, with the intervention, all right? The intervention's working. We may consider augmenting it or perhaps even adding some, increasing the magnitude slightly, but whatever we're doing appears to be working, and if we keep on doing that, over time, we should start to see some closing of the gap. So those students would be maintained in their current tier, be that Tier 2 or Tier 3, okay? And for those students as well here, sometimes what that means then, you know, it would mean if we come up to the winter benchmark, they still haven't met the winter benchmark now, and it's a moving target, but they're making good growth. Let's continue on. Let's continue on and see how they're doing this in the spring benchmark as well. Now, I know someone asked in, I think, in the first webinar, well, how long would you do this? Well, it depends. It depends. Here's a bit of a judgment call. I mean, in the case that I just made is that they're growing at, you know, double the expected slope coefficient. There's some likelihood that they're going to catch up, right? Well, let's say they're just kind of meeting that the 50th percentile 0.4. What you'll find over time is that what that will create is a situation where the student, where the gap is no longer getting bigger, but it's parallel, meaning is that their growth is equal to their peers, and whatever gap existed at the time you started the intervention continues, and it doesn't get any wider, and it doesn't get any smaller. It just kind of grows in parallel. If you see that over some time, then it might be a then you might want to consider, as I explained it in week one, is that moving to an eligibility determination with the question of disability, but more importantly is that then protecting their rights to accessing those specialized forms of instruction or whatever that has been going on in their tiered intervention. And again, typically those students, as we talked about in the example a couple of weeks ago, those are typically Tier 3 students, right? Tier 3 students. And then lastly, we will have a group of students who are continuing to be below the benchmark and who continue to demonstrate lower rates of growth or poor progress. And these are students that we would then consider to move tier to, if they're in Tier 2, to Tier 3, and if they're in Tier 3, possibly for an eligibility evaluation. The typical progression, as you probably expect, would be for students on your first time of screening. If they're yellow or at risk from Tier 2 to Tier 3. You do have found for districts that are just getting up and going on that first data screen or set of screenings, you might have more Tier 3 students that you typically do over years if you continue with the process. And that's because these students haven't hit the radar screen for whatever reason. Either if you're using teacher referral, there has been no teachers who has referred them before. Now you have this, you know, these red guys who appear, you know, if you just looked at them and say, well, where did they come from? But again, if with no referral mechanism, you would have them there. But over years, you should probably see fewer and fewer of these brand new red guys or Tier 3 or students who need that level unless they move into the district alike. Why? Because you probably should have screened them or at least they would have hit your radar screen in previous grade levels, okay? So what I'm saying here is that over successive years of using an RTI model, the data become more stable, they become more formative, and you make better decisions on that on those over the years. And I think I've given you some statistics a week or two ago that typically we, and students who are in Tier 2, where they be? Oh, they would be in this group here. We see probably 70-75% of students go back into tier one, right? As long as we start to catch them at the right time. This is with a couple, you know, it's not likely to happen the first year, but probably after two or three, certainly by 5 years, we want to see more and more students effective tier two intervention. What we've also seen, though, too, is over about a 5 to 7 year period in some of our evaluations, is that we see about a 50%, 50, reduction in the number of students who then move on to an eligibility determination. Okay, and it's not the case that we are, you know, some people sometimes think, well, you're withholding services then. No, it's probably the case that what we're doing now is getting a more, I don't want to say pure, but more, we're really now starting to see the students who are struggling mightily, and that their learning problems might be or may be truly due to some learning disability that has either a neurobiological or, you know, an endogenous factor to it, a real true processing problem. Whereas we're catching some of those other students who kind of look environmentally LD, sometimes we see in the literature, and we're able to get them back on track earlier on. Okay, so this is for us is a helpful heuristic about how do we use the progress monitoring data in combination with the benchmark assessment data to make decisions about the effectiveness of intervention at the different tiers. And again, we sit down at each new benchmark, which would be twice a year, or we could do it again in the fall for students who are returning. The challenge with students coming into the fall of the year is now that it's hard to use the previous benchmark or progress monitoring information, and their new benchmark will change because assuming that they've moved up a grade, they'll be responding to a different benchmark as well. Okay, so that provides us with a nice heuristic to make those decisions. The last thing I wanted to talk about is how do we use progress monitoring data formatively to assess instruction. Now, this would be the case, as someone asked last week, is typically more the case when someone said, well, where does instructional consultation fit in? So I don't want to cast that. I don't know. You might be using individual problem solving or instructional consultations in tiers two and three. And if that was the case, excuse me, you could use either one of these next couple kind of decision-making heuristics I'll show you in either of those tiers, okay? Typically, we don't use these in tier two when it's a kind of standardized intervention because, again, we just go with it for the 8, 9, or 10 weeks and then evaluate it at the next benchmark. But if you're doing it more through an instructional consultation approach or more problem-solving approach, you may not want to wait until 8 or 9 weeks have passed to try to figure out, should we be doing something differently, okay? So these are ways that we can do that, even though I told you a little bit ago that the data are going to be less reliable with only 5 or 6 data points, okay? But we have two ways to do that. One is we use the 5 most recent consecutive scores in our data run, and then the other one is we compare the student's trend line to the goal line. I'll show you what those are here, okay? So this one, the first one, we call the 5-point rule. Now, if you've ever been to one of Lynn Fuchs's or even the National Center uses what they refer to as the 3-point rule here, and I'll go into in a moment here why we use the 5-point rule. But it's pretty simple. You can see in this case, these last 5 data points are above the goal line. Okay, they're all above this. This is the goal line now, not the trend line, that goal line that we set. When the last 5 are all above, okay, we say raise the goal, okay? Keep the intervention, it appears to be working, and raise the goal, okay? Now, the reason why we don't use jump back here a moment, the 3-point rule is because we did some work on this again, and it really came one day I was kind of thinking about the 3-point rule, and I said, wow, you know, 3 points is basically if any one data point can either be above the line, below the line, or I guess you could say it would be exactly on the line, but I ruled that out just in my thinking. This is basically a coin flip, right? Heads or tails? Heads or tails? And what's the likelihood if I pulled a quarter out of my pocket and flipped it 3 times, a series of 3 times, what's the likelihood that it would just happen by chance to land 3 heads in a row and 3 tails in a row? And the likelihood is actually pretty high. It's so, and I can't recall what it is off the top of my head, but we have the data somewhere squirreled away in the manuscript. But it's basically that can happen by chance. And you want to amuse yourself on dark winter night here, try it for yourself. But what we then ask, okay, if that can happen by chance, how many data points should we, if we were to continue to use this rule, how many data points should we require to be above or below the goal line where we could rule out chance occurrence, okay? Now, you're never going to rule it out perfectly, but limit it. And what we found is that at seven, requiring seven above or below the line, you rule out chance down to less about 5%, less than 5%. The problem with seven is that that's very unlikely to happen, and often by the time you're at seven, you're close to completing a cycle between two benchmarks, and it's not likely that you want to do formative evaluation a little bit quicker than that. So at about five, we rule the likelihood of that occurring by chance is about 15%. That was a level at which we could be happy with. Okay, so that's why we choose the 5-point rule. It's often one that people refer to. In fact, the state of Connecticut about once a year sends me an email and says, wait, we just heard, we saw Fuchs or someone else required the 3 points. Why do you use five? And you said you had some substantiation for that, and that's why. And actually, the study that we did on this is called a Monte Carlo simulation. We did it. We had the computers run the simulated data for us, so we didn't even have to go out and collect the data. So here's an example, again, now where the five most recent data points, actually more than that, are all below the line, okay, goal line. So what should we do there? Okay. Well, this is cases that we want to modify the intervention, right? We never want to lower the goal. Assuming that this goal is developed with some kind of rationale, one of the three that we talked about before, we never want to lower the goal. So in this case, we want to modify the instruction. Notice I said modify. It doesn't mean that we have to throw the intervention out. Perhaps sometimes it's just modifying or providing more opportunities to respond, or more magnitude or more time. Okay, and then lastly, let me say if the three, the five most recent data points, neither are above and below, then we use the next approach that I'm going to talk about here in a moment. And actually, shall I say, is that we don't oftentimes find that the five most recent data points are all above or below the line, the goal line. So in those instances, what we then do is work back, and then we use an analysis based on the student's trend line, and we compare the student's trend line to their goal line. So in this case, again, here's our trend line. Show some phase shifts there, but here's the student's trend line over these eight data points. In this case, you can see that the trend line is steeper than the goal line. Well, in those cases, we want to increase the goal as we did before. Okay. Here's a case where the trend line is less steep or below the goal line. Well, here's a case again where we want to modify instruction. All right. Again, we don't want to throw the goal away. And then lastly, here's a case where the trend line's about parallel and pretty much snugging right up to the goal line. Well, in this case, we want to continue the intervention, continue the goal, and continue the progress monitor. The difference here would be is if the trend line was lower but parallel, then we'd probably want to modify the instruction. Okay, so I'll skip on there. Just so remember is that if it's much lower in parallel, we want to modify the instruction. So hopefully, I think if I was the kind of the big idea here today was with progress monitoring, is I see that there's probably two forms of that we could progress monitor, both with benchmark assessment and then with individual data. For benchmark assessment, we can use a program evaluation approach to look at trends in our data and progress over time, typically at the aggregate level, although we can do that individually too as well. When we take an individual child score and compare where they were from the fall to the winter and the winter to the spring, in essence, we're doing some progress monitoring. And then for those students who are in tiers 2 and 3 and perhaps in special education, we can look at them, we can progress monitor them individually. Rather than waiting from one benchmark period to the next, we want to collect at least weekly data on them. The basis or the summary statistic for those data are going to be the slope coefficient or some measurement of growth over time. And I know, for example, like newer assessments are using a growth value score, so we could use that as well. And then for making RTI decisions, we can use both of those pieces of information. I think probably the soundest approach for making decisions regarding instructional effectiveness is to use both pieces of information simultaneously at one point in time, again, typically corresponding to a benchmark assessment, and then seeing what has this child's rate of growth been in response to the intervention, okay, vis-a-vis individual progress monitoring, and then what has that resulted in terms of their changes on their benchmark assessment, okay? And as I said before, using that heuristic, we'll probably see one of three or four different students. But I think in using both forms of assessment, benchmark and individual progress monitoring, we make the soundest decisions about a student's response to intervention within an RTI or an MTSS program model. So I will stop there. See, it's a little after 5, and I will, it's probably time for any kind of questions. In the past, what folks have been doing is typing them in. So if you, and I'll know, I'll see a little thing that pops up on my side as typing. So people have questions about that, things that I've discussed today, or if you've been on online for the last couple of weeks, things that have come up in the last couple of weeks. Don't let that stop you. You can just. Okay, I see someone's typing in, so we'll wait here for a moment. Someone's typing in, so as soon as it comes in, I'll read the question off and kind of respond to it. Now, this is, now I'm getting worried. This could be a really long question. Okay, it should be coming in, I think, in a second. Either that or they gave up on it. Oh, no, she's back typing. Oh, here it is. Oh, it wasn't that long. Okay. Other than DIBLs or AIMS Web, can data for norms be attained, for example, reading rates? So, Kelly, I'm not if you're meaning like oral reading fluency scores or reading rates, certainly you could go to the literature for that. There's there have kind of been standards published in the reading literature. I know Fuchs and, again, their colleagues down at Vanderbilt have had those. You can look at those. The key thing here, though, is that oftentimes those are established in a methodology that many of us are familiar with, using mastery instructional or independent and instructional or frustrational levels in terms of performance. And while they might be useful for kind of like formative assessment or more informal assessment, they might be less than sufficient to make the kinds of decisions that you'll need to make in an RTI model vis-a-vis, particularly, I'm not as worried as between tiers, between the tiers, but particularly when you might start to consider, is this a student who needs special educational services? At that level, I'd want something that was more linked to normative, and when I mean norm reference here, it doesn't mean that it has a, I don't want to get confused with kind of like typical assessment approaches, but that there's some kind of normative basis to the data and that it makes sense to us. A good place to look for some of those two things I didn't mention today, I know having it been a task, is either on the website of the RTI for Success website or the intensiveinterventions.org website. And if you go under, I think it's under resources here, I'm going to try to do it right now. I have my laptop going at the same time. If you go under the tool chart, by the way, it's intensiveintervention.org, not with an S. I always do that. Yeah, it's right on the first page. It's called tool charts. And if you look under, click under that, you can choose from academic progress monitoring, academic intervention, or behavioral progress monitoring. You can get a sense of some of the other tools that are available to provide that kind of those kind of growth and normative data. Some of them, many of them are commercially available, some of them are author available, and you might be able to write, contact the authors to get some of that information as well. Okay? So I guess that maybe, certainly There's all kinds of different information that's provided by vendors, but I think to make the soundest decisions in an RTI model, you probably need ones that are linked and have some normative basis to them, relative as opposed to others that have some kind of that have been developed out of more an instructional approach, like I said before, and many reading measures would like that independent, instructional, and frustrational. I see Teresa's typing in. So they're still coming in. So as soon as the questions pop up, I'll read them out. Oh, okay, Kelly Roca, thanks. I like the idea of dynamical line. Great to show teachers progress. Yeah. As a speech pathologist. Yeah, I didn't realize you're a speech pathologist, Kelly. Yeah, actually, my experience has been a speech pathologist have been basically doing RTI. It's your model of practice in that, this is probably not anything that's new to you. My previous response, though, with normative tables, let me say I'm not as familiar with, kind of the speech instruments, but that you would use in your assessments. But your model of practice is one that's very tied. It's really a model of RTI. You use some kind of benchmark assessment. You design the intervention based on your expertise and the child's needs, and you evaluate that as it goes on. And if a student, if the problem's solved, they exit out or go back into tier one. So very interesting. So it's actually probably speech language is one of the few that we actually see the student exit from nowadays anymore. John, a lot of schools are using multiple data sets to determine progress. Ames, I assume you guys can see this question. So what would you recommend at a school to do when the data from each assessment are disparate? Example, Ames Web, progress managed score. Okay, so this is one that we entertained a couple weeks ago, I think, in a separate form. It creates a conundrum here, is that there's a couple different ways you can handle it. This is when you have, if a school's using a suite of assessments, if you will, either for progress monitoring or for benchmark assessment. Probably the best way, if you had someone on staff that had some statistical skill, is to come up with what we sometimes refer to as a propensity score. It's basically a composite score. Is that if I took, for example, in the area of benchmark assessment, and let's say we have a school using a running record, they're using Fonte Spinel, they're also using Ames Web, and throw in a fourth there, and then they come down to the point we're saying, well, who are our students who should we move to tier two intervention? One way to do it would be create a composite score, as I said before, where each one of those scores were weighted. Now, in order to do that now, you're going to have to use a couple, probably at least a year of normative. This would all be local now, normative information, so that you would take a year's worth of information across those four different score tests, put them into the equation, and then basically it's a multiple regression equation, and say, okay, what is the weighting? Okay, we're going to weight the Ames Web score 0.6, the running record 0.3, you get the idea, and then come up with a composite score, and that composite score then would be linked to some kind of outcome measure where you would say whether or not the child should be moved to tier two or not, okay? In the absence of that, let me say, so that would be one way, okay, on one end of the continuum. And on the other end of the continuum, what I sometimes see districts do is they just kind of cherry pick, if you will. They kind of look at the data, across all four measures, and they, you know, if they want to make a case that the child's in tier two, they find one of those four measures that confirm that, or if it's the converse, they'll find one of the four measures that don't and go with that. The problem with that is you run up with into inconsistent decisions, as you might know. Probably in the absence of having someone that could do the statistical analysis for you, what I would suggest is that through some kind of group consensus, is that folks agree on a limited number of measures, be they either one or two, that they use in making the decisions about tier movement between the tiers, or most importantly, is which students go into tier two. And if at that point, if I was the administrator, I would say that whatever measures we choose, they have to have some normative reference to them. Okay, so meaning they're within their development, within their technical specifications, their technical manuals, or their web portals, that they provide us with aggregate information that we know that we can compare our students to. Now, so that doing so at least is going to satisfy the user in knowing is that the information was gathered and compared to some norm-referenced assessment. What can happen still, though, even at that, is that maybe one assessment flags the need for support and another one doesn't. So if that's the case, then I think you have to either develop a heuristic that says in order for a student to move on to the next tier, they have to be lower on both, okay, would be one decision, or one or the other. What's going to happen, though, is if it's both, it might limit the number of students that, if we're thinking about screening for tier two, place a limit on the students who are in tier two. If you use one or the other, you might have what you might have is more students in tier two than you would expect. Okay, and this has to do, the problem has to do with when you use multiple assessment measures and you let anyone, either one of them, be the criterion, that when you have more of those, then you increase the number of students who could possibly get in, and you'd also likely increase the false positives. And we talked about that last week in screening too as well. Okay, so if I, again, what I would say is that they would have to minimally have in your case you said, for example, with Ames Webb's indicates below, but informal measures reflect progress similar to same age peers. In this case, I would stick with the Ames Webb, because that is the one that you know is linked to a normative, some kind of normative database, as opposed to the informal measures. I hope that answers. Our district is using the NWEA for universal screener and Ames Webb for progress monitoring in tier 2 and 3. How would you suggest correlating these two systems? We also administer FOSS. Okay, this is a variation on the previous question. FOSS and Pinnell collect alternate data, K through NWF. Wow. So, Tara, that's a lot of data collection, if you ask me. So, particularly the for Universal Angel. Okay, so you're using the NWEA and the FOSS and Pinnell three times a year. Okay, I guess that would make sense. I guess you could do it three times a year. I would, for me, that would be a little much. I would probably, if I was, you know, the one who said paint your blue sky here, I would probably say use the NWEA for making decisions about students, what students should go into tier two or qualify for intervention. From my experience with those two assessment instruments, the FOSS and Pinnell the teachers find it more better for designing their intervention, their instruction, more useful, shall I say, than the NWEA. While I like the NWEA kind of as a summative measure, I still have questions as to whether or not it has a great deal of instructional utility for teachers, and we're working with some districts that are using that as well. So what I would say then is that in those cases, I'd use the NWEA as the screener. For those students who are in tier two or qualify, then I would you could use the FOSS and Pinnell and teachers are typically use that for designing or helping them design instructional or tier two intervention. And again, I'm assuming it's an instructional consultation approach here rather than a problem solving approach rather than a one size fits all. Then the Ames Web, I don't know how you're going to reconcile using the Ames Web for progress monitoring. And that's, you'll be able to see, and the problem here is that you might be able to see adequate progress in Ames Web, but without knowing how it's tied back into the NWEA, it would be hard to, it would be hard, if not impossible, to see how if you still saw a student who was below a standard for NWEA, but was really, really kicking butt, for lack of a better term, on the Ames Web, it would not be clear as to why they're not meeting the goal on the NWEA. The NWEA is, for those who don't know as well, is an adaptive measure as well. So its structure is different than any of the other systems that you've mentioned here. You're not even going to get the students from one time period to the next. Unlike with like Ames Web, you're going to get the same three benchmark passages in the fall and winter. So you're going to get totally different questions on the NWEA thrown at you depending on the timing of the assessment and how you do on that assessment. So I'm afraid I'm at a loss as to how to tell you how to tie those two together. And then I see at the bottom in grade 2, you're using nonsense word fluency, phonological awareness, high frequency. Okay. Well, at least assuming that the NWF and the phonological awareness are coming from something, they're coming from Dibbles or Ames Web or something of that nature, I would rely more on those on the group norms that are provided at each one of those instruments. If they're not, unfortunately, if they're kind of like garden variety ones that you design in your district, while they might be useful, and actually, I know someone else is doing the diagnostic, the fourth session in this, I would say that I would move those over to my diagnostic suite of assessments and use them for planning instruction rather than evaluating in a formal way the effects of instruction. So I know it's beyond the scope of today, but typically when we develop our assessment systems, we want benchmark screening. We want progress monitoring forms of assessment. We want benchmark assessment, progress monitoring forms of assessment. Helpful if those two things, highly helpful if those two things come from the same vendor. And then we also have a collection of diagnostic assessments. Those are used to just inform instruction, not to gauge responsiveness over time. Okay. Or you could do, the same question answered is if you had someone in staff that could do the kind of analysis for you, you could do that as well. But you can see here's the problem mixing apples and oranges. It becomes quite challenging to come up with consistent decisions. So I'm afraid that I can't really, the answer is there's really no consistent way to do it. The best way is to use common assessments across the benchmark assessments and the progress monitoring. You see, Tyra's just saying, thanks, okay. So I see I have it's about almost 5:30 again, so I've went over each week. I apologize for that, but I also thank people for hanging on for the extra time here. So I'm going to turn it back over to Molly at this point in time. I know she probably has some housekeeping to do with the evaluations and the like. And again, I want to thank Teresa and New York State, your Technical Assistance Center, for inviting me to do these three webinars and actually keeping me in the loop over the last couple of years with your efforts. You're coming close to, isn't it? Wasn't it 2014, as I recall, when all grades K through 6 had to have their language RTI and reading, let's say, reading and literacy. So as I've mentioned in previous webinars too, I'm a product of the public schools in New York, growing up down in Westchester County and graduated from Walter Panis High School. So, all right, so thank you. Get through next week. Enjoy the holidays, and I'm sure that Teresa and I will be in some kind of contact at another point down the road. Thanks.
Thank you so much, John. I put a link to the survey evaluation on the main page. If everybody would take a few minutes, it's just 9 short questions. We do appreciate the feedback.
Yeah, and I got weeks. Yeah, thanks for those. Yeah.
Yeah, and the that will also go in an email to us. So if you don't get it down now, an email will be sent with that link. But if you could take a minute to do that, we appreciate it. Thanks, everyone. Have a wonderful holiday.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.